It being the appointed hour of 4 p.m., I now call this hearing on ballot measure 4, an act providing for the protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters, to order. And before we go forward, I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Meade Treadwell, Lieutenant Governor, and I'd like to ask and make sure that there's somebody on the hearing for the con side of the hearing. We have a proponent of the bill here. Is there anyone on representing con side at this point?
This is Jason Bruni, the president of the Alaska Miners Association, and I will be representing them.
Good afternoon, Jason. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Lieutenant Governor. Thanks.
Also, who else is online from the from state agencies at this point?
Lieutenant Governor, go ahead.
This is Michelle Hale. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation, Division of Water. I'm the director.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Charlie Swanton, the director for the Division of Sport Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you. Is Kyle on from DNR? Hearing no one from DNR, that's fine. We'll get questions back. Anyone else on from state agencies at this point? Okay, thank you. We just had, a fairly robust turnout for the marijuana hearing that we held here in Ketchikan, but we don't have very large turnout here for this hearing. But we'll go through the process and continue to add to the public record and go from there. My name is Meade Treadwell. I'm Lieutenant Governor, and law requires us to hold two hearings in each of the state's four judicial districts on an issue to be voted on an initiative. This initiative, an act providing for protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters, will be on the November ballot, and we will complete our 8 hearings on this before the 30 days before the election. The agenda before the hearing is that we present a sectional analysis summary and cost estimate of the bill. The pro side, who's represented here by the sponsors, will speak for 10 minutes. The con side will present for 10 minutes, and public testimony will be 3 minutes per person, though we do allow public testimony to go over 3 minutes if a person has questions for the sponsors, the opponents, or the state agencies. I also, in the interest of making sure the mechanics of how this bill would work and so forth, ask questions ourselves and encourage discussion between the opponents and the proponents and the agencies where there's some relevant information to get on the record. Summary of the proposed bill. This bill would attempt to provide protection of Bristol Bay wild salmon and waters within or flowing into the designated Bristol Bay fisheries reserves by requiring the legislative approval for certain large-scale metallic sulfide mines. It would require a law finding that the proposed mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay fisheries reserves and would be, in addition to other permits and authorizations, already required for such mines to operate in the region. The sectional analysis of the proposed bill. The bill the first section has a new statutory provision with 3 subsections to Alaska Statute 38.05.142, legislative approval required for certain large-scale mines to Title 38. In addition to permits and authorization otherwise required by law, the legislature must give final authorization for any, quote, large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation located within the watershed of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserves. The Commissioner of Natural Resources would be in charge of adopting regulations under the Administrative Procedure Act to implement the statute, and this bill defines large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation as a specific mining proposal to extract metals, including gold and copper, from sulfide-bearing rock, and that would directly rock that would directly disturb 640 or more acres of land. The other sections of the initiative would add new provisions to the uncodified law of the state, containing 10 specified findings by the people. The findings would generally provide for recognition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve as a region of statewide significance to sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries. Alaska's economy, the global fishing economy, and a region of cultural importance to Alaska Natives. The provisions outlined in the initiative do not retroactively take effect on any existing mining operations throughout the state. Now, I should say that this being a citizen initiative, the way it becomes law is that the citizens of Alaska vote on it. Lieutenant Governor shall certify the election returns, and an initiated law becomes effective 90 days after certification. So if this law passes, we would certify that probably mid-November, and it would become effective mid-February. This law is not subject to veto, and it may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date per the Alaska Constitution. And although the legislature may amend an initiative any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or vitiate the intent, and there have been several court cases that have helped clarify that fact. We worked with the Office of Management and Budget to do a cost estimate on this bill, as we do for all initiatives. We did not include speculative information, so we did not look at the pending Pebble proposal, for example, and look at taxes that might be deferred if this served to defeat the Pebble proposal. We did, however, look at the initial, the initial cost for the department to implement it, and the Department of Natural Resources reported that it would cost about $70,000, $52,000 of which are in personal services, to implement the bill. The Alaska legislature reported it would cost about $50,000 as an estimated cost in advising agencies in regard to processing record requests, legislative review process and hearing documents, and agency regulations review and revisions. Now, I will say that the legislature often hires consultants when it has a major issue before them, and that is not speculated upon in this cost estimate. So with that, Anders, I'd like to invite you forward as the proponent of the bill and give you 10 minutes to speak to the bill's provisions and your arguments as to why Alaskans should vote for it. And Kayla is bringing up a slideshow as he comes to the front. And I'll say that for those who are listening online, slideshows given at previous hearings are available on the state's online public records system, online public notice system, and you can find that at online.alaska.gov. Thank you, Anders. Could you identify yourself and your organization at the beginning of your testimony?
No problem. Thank you. Again, my name is Anders Gustafsson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Renewable Resources Coalition and Foundation, an organization based in Anchorage, Alaska, that represents hunting, fishing groups and organizations, as well as commercial fishing interests and local subsistence members as well, from communities in Bristol Bay and around the state. I'm here to speak on behalf of Ballot Measure 4, and to give a little context and history to this, I just wanted to touch back a little bit on some of the history of how we've gotten here and where we've come from. A lot of this has been spawned, obviously, from the debate on the development of Pebble Mine and where that is currently in the state. In historical pretense, we've been trying to get regulations put on the books to add some more scrutiny and oversight to any development project as large as something like the Pebble Mine. This bill has actually taken shape in different forms. It's been a bill introduced in the Senate as well, and had some public hearings in that regard. It was not advanced through the legislature, so the next step was to take it to the citizens and get it sponsored on the initiative ballots. We got all the signatures on this ballot last year, and Alaskans have overwhelmingly supported the concept of having a say in whether a project the size and scale of Pebble Mine in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve should go forth or not. As I go through, I want to give a little history on the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. I've gone to a slide that shows Jay Hammond's picture. He was the senator at the time who created this fisheries reserve, and this was back in 1972, and it was a little piece of legislation that was created that added a small amount of oversight to any kind of project that would be proposed and permitted into Bristol Bay that could affect the fishery. Most specifically, it was developed for oil and gas leases. At the time, I believe Mineral leases was on one draft of it, but it had been removed at that time. Again, to reflect on the time frame, this was in 1972, long before any large-scale hard rock metallic sulfide deposits had been identified or even conceived of. So, in fact, what we're trying to do with this bill is to solidify and update this piece of legislation from 1972 to make it relevant for today's threats and things that could affect the fishery today. That being said, the mineral claims that are around the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, which I'll show you on a map, anything over 640 acres, a large-scale metallic sulfide mine, would then be subject, after it has gone through the appropriate permitting process, to a final review where the public would have the possibility to weigh in and through their legislature, have a vote of yes or no, whether they believe that this project would endanger the fishery. I also think that shows that in the past we've had a history of the state of trying to protect the Bristol Bay area, the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. It's a very significant importance to our state, to our culture, to the people of the region, and economically speaking, also important to the country. The map I'm showing now shows the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. It's a very large area, a watershed that encompasses the Nooshiegak River drainage, the Quijack River drainage, Lake Iliamna, all the way down through Naknek, King Salmon, and beyond, all the way down to Pilot Point and Ugashik. Basically, all of the waters that flow into Bristol Bay and the river drainage is there. The Nooshiegak River, which should be noted, that is the largest run of King Salmon most years anywhere in the state, and is one of our last great King Salmon runs, even when we are struggling with our King Salmon elsewhere, trying to find ways to protect our King Salmon. I think that this is an important piece of this bill, is that this adds an opportunity to help protect our King Salmon populations there, our wild populations. The region, in the middle of it, you can see the mining claims on this map, and it shows about 1,000 square miles of mining claims that were subsequently claimed after the pebble deposit was touted as being one of the largest, richest finds. As we know, the pebble deposit has gone through many phases of promotion and falling apart, loss of investment, up and down where it's at today, and many people will disagree with you on the status of the pebble mine at this point, whether it's never going forward, dead on its own merits, or still seeking more funding and new partners to advance. Either way, we feel that because most mines in Alaska have been permitted when they've asked for their permit applications, in fact, I believe all of them have made it through the permitting process that I know of, this is the statistic I've been given, we feel that it's, with the importance of the fishery, it's worth an additional review of the legislature and the public to be able to basically measure whether they think that the cumulative effect of all of these permits being granted and the project as a whole could endanger and put the fishery at risk. The key word in that is danger, not harm. Legalese, danger means risk, and you would be possible putting the fishery at risk, not whether you've killed a single salmon or not. It's basically to measure the impact to the entire fishery. So there's a few reasons why we really would like people to support ballot measure 4. And one of those reasons is the fact that this reserve produces half of the world's wild salmon supply. There's almost $500 million a year of economic revenue to the state, economic activity in the state. And it's, that's discounting the commercial revenue, not including the sport, all of the lodges, all of the businesses that then base their operations off of that fishery. Large-scale mining and pebble, we feel, should have to follow the same rules that oil and gas has followed since 1972. This rule has been in place. It has not impeded oil development in other portions of our state. It has not had a trickle effect into or creep effect into other industries. We think, therefore, it's a good model and something we would like to advance and see used. This goes back to when they used to write laws in very simple terms, in plain English. I wish we had more of that these days, something that people can understand. It's been told that I've been heard that the opposition has said that this bill would create a burden to the legislature. I'd just like to say that on that note, I think that the Bristol Bay fishery is important enough that we as Alaskans should take the time to fully evaluate and make sure that we have it right, that we don't rush into these things, and that these decisions aren't made without the full disclosure to the public, and they're not just happening behind an agency door by several unelected bureaucrats who aren't accountable to the voters of Alaska. The ballot measure 4 is specific also to the watershed. So we really like the fact that this proposal does not reach out and affect other areas of the state. We've been talking about this issue as, especially when we talk about Pebble or other large mines in the area, it's about this mine and this place. It's about this watershed. And this is a unique opportunity where we can create a rule for just specifically that watershed. Just throwing through some pictures to show the diversity of the fishery. All five species of salmon, rainbow trout, grayling, Arctic char, burbot, spiny duck, or sculpin, slimy sculpin, you name it. All these fisheries are very robust in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve and incredibly valuable to the state of Alaska. We believe that how does Metal Measure 4 protect salmon? Metal Measure 4 mandates that Alaskans have a say in a project, whether a project could be put in the reserve fishery or would put the fishery in danger via their elected representation in the legislature. I've often heard that, do you trust to put this in the decision in the hands of a this legislature? And I say to them, this would never be approved by this legislature, partly because it would have to be after the permitting process. It could be any legislature down the road. But this is the process that we have to work through, and this is how the public can be involved. Currently in the permitting process, you're allowed to make comment, and those comments would have to be considered. But in this, with this law enacted, you would have a say and be able to vote through your legislature, yes or no, whether you would like a project like this to proceed in the Bristol Bay fishery. I think that that's a good opportunity for us to put back a little bit more of the public process that we've lost with the loss of the Coastal Zone Program and other things that, where the Alaska public and an owner state have lost the opportunity to weigh in on big projects. Like I said, it puts the agency's approval process into the public arena for scrutiny and review by occurring after the permitting process. It does not circumvent the permitting process. It also sets that standard, like I said before, of no danger, in other words, risk, for the fishery project to gain approval. And I think that that's really important, that the state would have to have a finding, which would mean public testimony and hearings, just like what we're having here today, where you would be able to bring up experts, and experts would then be able to deliberate whether a large-scale mining project would put the fishery at risk. Finally, I'd just like to quote again, like we had said before, Ted Stevens was one of the great leaders of the state who had the gumption to come out against this project early on, and his point was that I'm not opposed to mining, but this is the wrong mine for the wrong place. And adding a level of protection where everybody has an opportunity to weigh in on their opinions on that, I believe, is the best way forward for the state of Alaska. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Gustin, thank you very much. Dr. Bruni, do you have a presentation, a slide presentation? Do we have that, or no?
So, we'll just be giving an oral presentation.
You're on.
Great. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and it's with particular appreciation of the people in Ketchikan today, and specifically I'd like to point out former Majority Leader Kyle Johansson and then Sonia Christensen, now Sonia Hendrick, who both are from Ketchikan, who were instrumental in the passage of HB 36, which ultimately led to these hearings being held. So thank you to both of them and to those that are in the hearing room. I appreciate you being there today. Ballot Measure 4, the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, stands to politicize the permitting process by requiring legislative approval in addition to the existing National Environmental Policy Act process and other permitting requirements that would take place at a mine in the Bristol Bay region. The problem with citizen initiatives is they have too many unknowns, and this initiative is no exception. It brings uncertainty to Alaska's investment climate and sets a bad precedent that can easily creep into other venues in Alaska. It will certainly pose additional burden to the legislature and permitting agencies, and frankly, without any added benefit to our environment. Above all of this, the initiative is very likely unconstitutional. The constitutionality of the existing Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve has never been tested in courts. Our Constitution prohibits special and local legislation, and most importantly, the separation of powers has had serious concerns expressed by at least one Alaska Supreme Court justice. It is important to note that Ballot Measure 4 will not stop Pebble. Should the Pebble project submit a mine plan and receive the multitude of permits such a project would need, then denial by the legislature at that point would be purely political. Now, at the last hearing that we held, there was some discussion of the legislative history, and I did some research in between now and then, which, Lieutenant Governor, I shared. I sent that to you, and I want to quote a couple of things. First and foremost, the initial bill was written to include mining leases within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Then Senator Hammond specifically wrote a committee substitute that removed mining from the initial bill. Again, Senator Hammond intentionally removed it. At that point, when the bill did pass, then Governor Egan sent a letter, which I again have included for the record, where he made some of the exact points that we've made in the previous hearings. And I'll just quote that. This is from Governor Egan. Quote, in contrast to earlier proposals, the boundaries of the reserve in this legislation do not include any presently leased tracts of state tide land. Therefore, earlier constitutional problems that would likely have required substantial compensation payments to lessees within the reserve have been eliminated. End quote. As was brought up at previous hearings, obviously, this is changing the rules after the fact. So there are current leases, mineral leases within the area that is discussed. Secondly, I'd like to point out that Governor Egan ultimately allowed this to become law without signing it. So he still had concerns, but he allowed it, and it has never been tested in the courts. One of the things that frustrates me the most about what was said by the previous speaker was the lack of faith, obviously, that they have in the permitting process. The EPA, the Corps of Engineers, the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Fish and Game, all have qualified experts, scientists, geologists, hydrologists, biologists, whose job it is to ensure that fishing and mining and any other activities that will be considered as part of a permit application are considered and are allowed, ensured that they will coexist. What this law is saying is that they don't trust that process. If there is a problem with the process, then they should change the requirements within NEPA, what is called the Magna Carta of the environmental movement. They should make changes specifically to state laws for making any mining project or any project, adding requirements there. Putting this before a vote of the legislature is scary. You're going to be entrusting non-experts to vote on something that they don't have the expertise to be able to. You're taking away the power from the experts. You are subjecting potential projects basically to the most money given Citizens United. I'm subjecting our permitting process to those who can raise the buy the most votes through independent expenditures. We have a rule of law for a reason. I think the example that was given at the last hearing is one that is a perfect example of the DMV. If you're wanting to get your driver's license and you go, you pass the driving test, you pass the written test, if you were to go and get your, at that point, you've done everything that's required to get your driver's license. Nope. At that point, we are going to make the legislature vote on whether you should get your driver's license or not. That is something very similar here, and that's just unacceptable. That is just inappropriate. We have permitting agencies whose job it is to make sure that projects in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve or throughout the state are done properly, protecting the existing resources, the fisheries resources, the wildlife, you name it. That is the rule of law that should be continued to be followed. Alaska's permitting process should be scientific. It should not be political. With that, Lieutenant Governor, I will yield the rest of my time. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to ballot measure 4.
Thank you, Dr. Bruni. Are there any people here or online around the state who'd like to testify now including asking questions of state agencies. Mr. Weinstein, Mayor? Okay. Anyone online?
This is Kimberly Williams, and I'm online.
Kimberly, you have the floor for 3 minutes, and if you got questions, we can take a little bit longer.
All right, thank you. My name is Kimberly Williams, and I live in Dillingham, Alaska, which is part of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. And my father and back then Senator Hammond were leaders of the time that really looked at the industry and always wanting to protect fish. And so here we are, fast forward 40 years, almost 40 years, or over 40 years today, and we're still having mega projects, industrial projects out here in Bristol Bay, and we have politicians come in all the time saying they won't trade fish for a mine. We have DNR, we have state employees that say they won't trade fish for a mine, but I'm here to tell you as a citizen of Alaska and somebody who resides in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, this added protection going one step further to me gives me a process where that I can have a say, and I can go down and I can talk to my legislature and say these are some of the issues that we have problems with. I can go to DNR, the committees that oversee DNR, and I can say this is the problem. And I can't. I mean, I look at what's been done in the past, and I look at HB 77, and I look at DNR and their own history these past 10 years, and making it so much easier for big, large projects out here in Bristol Bay to get permitted. And for me, as a citizen, I want to be able to go down and say, no, Bristol Bay is one place that we cannot trade a mine or oil and gas development for fish, and fish should come first, and that's why I am going to support ballot measure 4. Thank you.
Thank you. Kimberly, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask the state agencies?
Well, I guess I would like to, and I don't know where, I didn't hear all of this, the agency presentation. Was it just Dr. Burney?
Dr. Burney is representing the Alaska Miners Association. He's president of the Alaska Miners Association. But we have folks from DEC who oversee water quality, people from Fish and Game who oversee fisheries, and we may have somebody from DNR online. There wasn't when I called the roll before, but at any rate.
I would ask whatever state agency that oversees dam safety, and I believe it's DNR, why in the dam safety rules, when we talk about dam safety and given the Mount Polly event that happened down in Canada, why don't we have part of dam safety, the seismic activity, that why do we treat water reservoir dams the same as we treat metallic or sulfide mining dams? That's a question that I have for DNR.
Is there anybody, is Kyle online or anyone from DNR online?
Lieutenant Governor, this is Jack DeMarkey from the Office of Project Management and Permitting.
Jack, thank you for identifying yourself. Can you attempt to answer the question?
I'm not with the dam safety unit, but I will say that in regulation, there isn't a distinction between the water dams and the tailings dams, but the same engineering criteria apply to both. And so they would both be jurisdictional dams. And the historic seismic activity is taken into account in the design of those dams.
Kimberly, did you have any further question on that?
Can I ask Jack when the dam safety regulations are being updated?
I'm not aware that there's a process right now to update them. So I guess I'd have to tell you I can't answer your question.
All right, thank you.
And we do have somebody from. We do have Michelle Hale from DEC. Michelle, just along those lines, is for a dam that is taking mine waste, is there a liner usually required?
Lieutenant Governor, that is also probably a question that's more appropriately asked of the dam safety program. Sometimes a liner is required and sometimes it's not, and it's really an engineering question. It's a question to be answered by those engineers that design and then review and approve that mine, whether the liner makes sense or not.
Okay. And does Red Dog have a liner? I'm trying to remember if Red Dog does or Fort Knox does.
Red Dog has a liner on the face of the dam, but the tailings impoundment itself is not lined.
And the reason why I asked about the liner is to help on Michelle's question, Kimberly's question rather, of differences between say a water dam and a tailings dam.
There is no one size fits all with regard to a requirement for a liner, so it's handled on a case by case basis. And if a proponent proposes one with or without a liner, it still has to meet the criteria of DNR in terms of dam safety, and it has to meet DEC's requirements in terms of protecting the environment.
Thank you. Do the proponents or opponents want to say anything to this question?
I just like to point out, as a proponent for the initiative, relevant to the mine safety, as we just saw, I don't know if those of you who are listening online or anything have heard about this Mount Polly. It's about 400 miles away from this area, I believe, where there was a large tailings dam failure. I guess our point of our consideration of why we don't trust completely all the things that we're told is that is a great example where Pebble proponents have pointed to a current modern mine that has been constructed with the most advanced science and gone through, at least in this example, Canada's process, where it has had failure. And it's not all that uncommon that tailings dams fail, and therefore we're concerned about the risk of the fishery from said failure. It was also the same engineering firm that designed that dam that was also previously contracted in the early designs of the Pebble dams, which would have been over 700 feet tall, 3-4 times as large as what the Mount Polly tailings dams were. So it's that level and that intensity of this project and the proposal that we've seen out from Pebble that has caused us to be very concerned that anything after it's gone through the permitting process has really had a full comprehensive review. I know that in the past, and this could be a follow-up question possibly for one of the agencies that could answer this for me, is that the Rock Creek mine was an example in Nome of a mine that recently went through the permitting process but then failed for different reasons. And I've heard several of them, whether it's electric component or economics. And I guess that just kind of puts an example to me of where you've gone through this permitting process, but there is no permit to measure the economic viability or feasibility of a project like this. There's no multidiscipline evaluation of it where the legislature could actually do that through these hearing process. And Mr. Bruni has pointed out that these are not the experts, but they're not the experts in anything that they're asked to deliberate on. It's our public process. They're asked, experts come to the testifying, and they test them, and then the people evaluate those testimonies, and they are asked to relay our concerns as citizens and ask our and represent us not to be the experts of every one of these issues.
Thank you. Jason, did you want to say anything in response to the question or the answer given to Ms. Williams?
Well, two things. I definitely am going to ask for Jack DeMarkey to respond to the comments about Mount Polly and Rock Creek, but I can tell you that constantly, in my experience, the permitting agencies are working to ensure that their permits are up to best practices. They're always making sure that any learnings that happen from incidents like Mount Polly are incorporated to permits in Alaska to ensure that the oversight is going to protect our water and our fish, and to subject these type of questions to an electorate, to our legislature, is grossly inappropriate. These requirements and these permits are renewed on a regular basis, and they new requirements are put in place for these projects by the Department of Natural Resources. And so I'm I'm just a little concerned at if there are issues that needed to be changed with requirements, those specific things should be addressed, not having the legislature give the thumbs up or thumbs down. That is, they don't have that expertise.
Thank you. Mr. DeMarkey, would you like to speak about the poly to Jason's question?
Just a couple things. I think we feel we have to be real careful because there's not much known about Mount Poly, and I think we're all looking forward to learning something from the investigation that's undergoing there. I would make some distinctions and just caution people about making direct comparisons between the Mount Poly Dam and dams in Alaska. There is fundamentally different design at Mount Poly. It was what's generally referred to as an earth-fill dam. And at our dams at mines in Alaska, we have rock-fill dams. So they are pretty different animals. Why it failed, we don't know. The other question was about Rock Creek. I'm not sure what the point was. Rock Creek did go into production for a short period of time. They had some startup problems and made the decision, I think, through largely due to lack of capital to work through those problems. In a way, it's a success story in the sense that they did bond for closure, and that mine has been successfully closed. I'm not sure if he wanted any more information than that.
No, I guess I was highlighting the point that it had been permitted, and then even though it's gone through this rigorous permitting process, that it had to be shut down on its own account for other reasons, and it just seems to me that that leaves an opening for us to review how rigorous our permitting process really is.
Thank you. Kimberly, do you have any other questions that you'd like to ask?
Well, I appreciate the discussion on dam safety because living out here in Bristol Bay and Dillingham, and when we look at pebble and we look at any kind of large-scale mining out here in Bristol Bay that has sulfides in it that can cause acid mine drainage in the future, these are questions on dam safety are big questions. And when I look back into the history, Red Dog had problems and had a breach. Rock Creek had problems. The Mystery Creek mine had problems. And so, to me, there are problems, and we can say we have rigorous permitting process and we do the best practices possible, but engineers don't always get it right, and they are the experts, and they don't always get it right, and it's to the detriment to the people out here in Bristol Bay, and that's another reason why we need this opportunity to go down and testify to our own elected officials to say, listen, extra scrutiny does nobody any harm. And in fact, I guess the question I have in terms of this ballot measure, what is the cost for if this gets passed, what is the cost to DNR and to DEC to go that one step further, to go in front of the legislature and ask them and testify in front of them?
Well, I can answer that question, you know, at present. Right now, the cost that we had in the state was we estimated a fairly small amount, which I had in the slideshow at the beginning, but it's a total of approximately $52,000, $70,000 at DNR, approximately $50,000 to the legislature, as well as the share of the cost that the Lieutenant Governor's office has for this initiative, which is not part of the answer to your question. So you're talking about something in the neighborhood of $125,000 or $140,000, if I'm adding right. Let me see here. So that was the answer that was provided when we did the cost estimate at the time the initiative was submitted to us. Is there any further testimony that people would like to offer today? Hearing that, let me ask a couple of questions if I can for the record. First off, we had a discussion, and I looked this up and have this and wanted to enter this into the record from our Juneau hearing. The question that had come up is to when was it appropriate for the legislature to pass a an authorization under the oil and gas part of the law. And I'm going to read into the record the law that, Section Alaska Statute 38.05.140, limitations in the state land law that says the submerged, F says the submerged in shoreland lying north of 57 degrees 30 minutes north latitude and east of 159 degrees 49 minutes west longitude within the Bristol Bay drainage are designated as the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, a surface entry permit to develop an oil and gas lease or an exploration license under AS 38.05.131 to 38.05.134 may not be issued on state-owned or controlled land until the legislature by appropriate resolution specifically finds that the entry will not constitute danger to the fishery. So I guess the first thing that answers is the question that we had the other day, which is, does this happen before or after leasing? It can happen after leasing. It's not required to get this authorization before leasing, but it is required to get this authorization before you enter state-owned or controlled land to do exploration or development. The second thing is that this current law is a legislative resolution, not a law. And so a legislative resolution, when they say appropriate resolution, does not necessarily require the signature of the governor. Some resolutions get the signature of the governor. Some of them don't. And so the so two houses can do it without the governor. It does have about the same general standard. I'm just looking at
this one says a duly enacted law, though.
Right. Yes. And the measure before us, it does call for a law, not a resolution. So it's a different legislative process. And then in the proposed law on mining, it says this authorization shall take the form of a duly enacted law finding that the proposed large-scale metallic sulfide mining operation will not constitute danger to the fishery within the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. And let me just see if I can tease out what because the current law also says the resolution has to find that the entry will not constitute danger to the fishery. Could I ask both sides here, as well as the folks who manage our fisheries who are on for fish and game, could each of the three of you give me your view of what the words danger to the fishery mean? And then talk with you, Mr. Gustafson. Yes.
First?
Yeah.
When I hear the words danger to the fishery, I think of it in the large-scale sense. And this is how I've had it described to me as well, that we're not asking the question of whether you would kill a salmon with your activities, i.e. dig up a small piece of or put something across a stream and kill 10 fish. It's a question of, does the activity create the opportunity for some sort of, say, catastrophic failure like Mount Pawley? Where you could actually have a catastrophic effect to the fishery, which would mean, in this case, a lot of these mines are at the headwaters of these two productive salmon streams, and if you were to contaminate the spawning habitat for, say, 30 miles of a river, 15 miles of a river, would that have a cumulative effect to affect the entire fishery and the value of that fishery? That's the level of what we're asking. It's a big-scale project, large impacts, not the specific, because you could get a permit for currently to displace a certain amount of rivers or watersheds. There isn't any particular permit I know of that actively says you can't kill salmon. So what we're asking is the broader question is that, could this affect the economics of the fishery? Would this affect, say, the lodge businesses? Could this affect, all of those things and how it is described as a fishery?
So it includes the economics of the fishery in your mind. It includes
the fishery,
economics of the lodge business in the sport fishery.
I think of it as a biological sense, but I'm saying that the biological affection of a fishery would then in turn affect any of these economic portions. In my mind, it's a question of whether does it biologically would it biologically affect the fishery or put it at risk. The fundamentals, the actual runs of the salmon, not those things. If you did affect those, obviously you would affect the economics. Is my point.
All right. And
you're not measuring
and it's so So it has to do with the biological health of the fishery, not directly with the economic health.
This is how I understand it.
That's how you understand it.
Yeah,
okay.
The fishery.
Dr. Bruning, how do you understand it?
Biologically, Lieutenant Governor, miners don't kill fish. Fishermen kill fish. So, but for ADF&G and their requirements, fishermen would kill all the fish. And so I would say that is what a danger to the fishery means. And that was why we ultimately became a state. One of the reasons was because of the fish traps that were coming in and killing all the fish. That is a danger to the fish. I think it's important to point out, Lieutenant Governor, with what you just said about the reading that into the legislative record, that the governor, in allowing this to become law, envisioned the lack of the constitutional issues and also envisioned the potential takings issues requiring, quote, substantial compensation payments to lessees within the reserve. So I think it's important to have that on the record, Lieutenant Governor, as a significant danger to the state of Alaska, should this become law, of a takings.
All right. But Jason, that was actually my next question, was about the takings issue. But the question that I had about danger to the fishery is really as follows. First off, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Obviously, I don't endorse what happened in Maupali. You know, there did it ultimately. Did it ultimately prove out to be a danger to the fishery? Do we know that there are not fish coming back? We don't know.
It's too early to tell on that. Yeah, okay. I don't think the scientists have found out. And then if I could just respond to his.
Well, no. Let me just stay on this issue of biological versus economic, because as your lieutenant governor today. I might be speaking somewhere in the nation or somewhere in the world promoting our fish, which I do, and you're a fisherman, and I hope you get the best prices for the best quality ever. That's part of my job. And I am often asked, well, is this fish any good anymore because of that pebble mine? And I have to explain the pebble mine is, one, not operating, and two, you know, so would you consider economic perception in the marketplace be part of the fishery or not? Or is it just the biology in the marketplace?
That's a good question. I mean,
the biology and the resource.
Yeah.
Okay, so your initial testimony talked about the biology, not the general perception.
As I understand it.
Okay. All right. And I don't know what the legislative history showed when the same words were used in Senator Hammond's then bill. Jason, just in terms of that issue, if you had anything more on that, I was then wanted to turn to Fish and Game and say, what do they biologically, as managers, consider to be a danger to a fishery?
Lieutenant Governor, I don't have anything else to add to that question. Other than no project will be permitted if it will put the fishery at danger. It's a loaded question.
Okay, and to the Department of Fish and Game, what protections do you have right now to avoid danger to the fishery?
Mr. Chair or Lieutenant Governor, I thought that the question was, you know, what would we consider to be a working definition of danger to the fishery, and what I had, you know, quickly off the top of my head would say some sort of large-scale catastrophic loss, and that would be possibly either within a single year or within multiple years. And I would probably characterize that best or provide an example of along the lines of, you know, the effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And that being that although biologically most of the damage was done, at least in terms of salmon stocks, by over escapement or not harvesting the available harvestable surplus and putting too many salmon on the spawning grounds, specifically with regards to pink salmon, and chum salmon, and that had a multiple year effect. You know, and when you talk about a fishery, you know, a fishery has got, you know, a human element in that those are the fishermen, those are the extractors, but it also has a biological element associated with it in that, you know, stocks have an inherent surplus that is available to harvest and, you know, in a long-term sustained basis. But, you know, it's difficult to try and pinpoint, you know, an exact answer to the question that you were posing secondarily.
Okay. And I guess I would note, again, not speaking for or against the legislation, there is a provision that says the commissioner, being the commissioner of DNR, can adopt regulations to implement this section. So quite possibly you could have a regulatory process to define, quote-unquote, danger to the fishery. And I appreciate your answer. I guess the second question I have, first for the proponent, and it was raised not only by Jason, but it's one that I had as well, is given the legislative history on this, that the initial boundaries of the fisheries reserve were changed to prevent the state having to pay for takings issue. Have you considered the possible takings costs to the state here on the projects that are already underway within this arena?
The takings argument came up years ago too. I know we've looked at other, you know, issues along with the Bristol Bay and the Pebble Mine. And as far as I have been told from attorneys, the takings would not take place unless a project had been approved completely through the entire process, which would then also include this bill. So as I understood it, they had made it through the entire permitting process and then made it through the legislative review process that this bill affords, and then somehow it was removed, then there would be a possibility for takings claims. But since this would be part of the process, they would have to completely go through it all before you'd ever get to a takings. If this isn't part of the process, then I guess that would take place after a permitting, after all the permitting had been given to it. And then someone pulled it out, but we'd be actually creating a bill, which is part of the process. So that process would then extend through this review, as I understand that.
Okay. Dr. Bruni, do you have an answer to that?
I think that's the $500 billion question, Lieutenant Governor. I think that the Department of Law should be requested to give its interpretation. I don't have an answer. I don't agree with Anders and his read, but I think it's subject to interpretation, and it could potentially put the state of Alaska at significant economic risk.
Okay, and toward that end, I can tell you, as we looked at the cost estimate and looked at the issues, this one of the biggest challenges we have at the Department of Law when we render opinions on this is that if we state that we might be subject to takings, we're giving evidence to those who would take us to court for taking. So the Department of Law doesn't really like to speak to those issues. I'll just say in my own personal experience, but we can certainly ask that question, or you can ask that question as well, and we'll see. And Barbara, help me follow up on that. I guess the takings question that Governor Egan may have had in mind may be separately, more along the lines of the objective versus the subjective work of a permitting agency versus the legislature. I mean, when a legislator votes yes or no, there's no requirement that legislator vote on any criteria except for following the Constitution. I mean, even if the law says you have to have a law that says this, the legislator could vote for it based on many, many other different reasons, you know. The point that I think would come up in the takings discussion might not accept that this is part of the process and therefore not done. And you know, that's the point. Somebody may say, well, you get through the objective process where we've, you know, graded this project against measurable water quality standards or measurable engineering standards or something along those lines, and then subjected it to a less than objective process. and so therefore could be seen as a takings. But that's the argument for courts to decide, not for me to decide or define, but I just want to lay that's the discussion that I heard on takings on the table. Those constitute all of my questions today. We talked about timing on the issue before, and I just would say that the question has come up again and again what does a final authorization mean when a project may change its scope one way or the other. And if you'd like to answer that question again, you told me that you've done some work on that, Mr. Gustafson, and I'd give you the record on that right now.
Sure, that'd be fine. As I've done research on that, it's basically up to the courts they would use a rule of reasonableness, which would fundamentally evaluate whether a permit change affects the nature of the project as a whole, where it would need to be reviewed again through the entire process. The intention of the initiative is to not have that happen if a project has asked for, let's say, moving a drainage ditch 100 yards to one side. It doesn't fundamentally change the nature of the project. But if the project went from underground block cave mine and then they asked for the permits to change it into an open pit mine, I think that under any court's reasonable rule of reasonableness, you would see that is by its very nature a new and different project, and that would be a different story altogether, and would require another approval. It would send it back far enough that the project fundamentally changes. I would like to see that no shenanigans are pulled there, and people can't try and get in with one concept saying, hey, we're going to build this, we listen to your concerns, we want to build this real small project, just to start getting the permits and get the feet in the door, and then go ahead and fundamentally change the project, which is common in large-scale mining. It's happened around Colorado. I've seen it, and I've done a lot of research on this, where a lot of mines started out as small projects where the permitting was slightly easier, and then as the economics have changed and the area has changed, that then large projects or some of those block cave mines are then caved in to get the rest of the resource and turned into open pit mines. Okay. That's something we've got to prevent that happening.
Okay, and we... let me just say that I think what I'm trying to tease out and understand is the proposal here says a final authorization must be obtained. And if you had said an additional authorization as opposed to a final authorization, I might believe what you're saying is true. I'm the words final to me says last in mind. After you've walked through the entire line at Walt Disney to get on the ride, the final authorization is whether or not you have the same, the appropriate height to get on the Ferris wheel. And if you get all the way through the gauntlet and the law says final, then that means final. And if something else comes up, and it could be as de minimis as needing some DEC permit to deal with your old batteries, or it could be something as important as changing the scope of the mine. I you've told us what your intent is, and the reason why I wanted to make sure that I was on the record is because final to me means the last thing in mind. So it might be if your lawyers have any comment on why they chose that word as opposed to an additional authorization, that would be useful to have on the record. Dr. Bruni, do you have any comments on this?
No, Lieutenant Governor.
And just asking the folks at DNR, how do you read the word final?
This is Jack at OPMP, and I guess we don't read it. We would leave it up to the legislature to come up with a definition of that.
Proposed law says that you can adopt regulations, so you might end up coming up with a definition of the word final, too. Is that correct?
And if we do, then I guess we will. I mean, I can tell you how we do it now. We are often issuing modifications to approvals, and minds do change. I think that was an accurate statement. They they sometimes get bigger, or sometimes they move into a different ore body, or sometimes they adopt a new process in the mill. So it is fairly common for our large mines to, for us to be modifying plans of operations approvals or updating closure plans and bonds. So I'm not at all sure how the legislature would treat the term final.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. We have one person who has come to testify, as I understand. No, you've just come to observe? Okay, thank you. I had one other question, and then I'm ready to close the hearing unless there's any others online who'd like to testify. Dr. Bruni, in your opposition statement, you said that the fisheries reserve was untested as far as local and special legislation, and you mentioned a constitutional issue and separation of powers. Do you have any specific first off, are you aware of any other cases like this where the local and special legislation has been found and where laws have been rejected by the courts as unconstitutional on that basis?
Lieutenant Governor, there was a legislative legal memo with respect to SB 152, which questioned the separation of powers and whether existing law requiring legislative approval of oil and gas is constitutional. So that's an example that I know of from the that I could refer you to. So
okay.
It probably
like,
might be good to get a copy of that and submit that for the record.
Yeah, if you'd like to submit that for the record, you're welcome to do so.
Okay.
I just want to point out, too, that they did take this, the Fellow Partnership did sue to have this initiative not put on the ballot, and the Supreme Court evaluated those and concluded that it was not local and specific, that the area was important in nature to the entire state of Alaska, and therefore they did not give it local and specific. They didn't rule on that.
In fairness, Lieutenant Governor, those issues are often, and the judges often say this, dealt with if and when the issue passes through the vote of the people. And so they default to the vote, and then at that point they deal with the local and specific constitutionality of the issue. There is significant history of that happening.
I understand that, and I also understand that while as the defendant I won that case, I have yet to see the final opinion from the Supreme Court on that issue, which may speak to that as longer. Okay, well, is there anyone else who's interested in testifying on this issue at present? I'm going to ask my proponents, opponents, if there's anything else you'd like to say for the record. Otherwise, we'll call the hearing to a close. Hearing none. Yes.
Lieutenant Governor, this is Michelle Hale with DEC Division of Water, and I wanted to return to the biological question briefly, if I could.
Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome. When we permit wastewater discharges, which we do under it's the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program, one of the things that we have to conclude after a rigorous analysis is it's our requirement to conclude that existing water uses and the level of water quality necessary to protect existing uses must be maintained and protected. So we have to look at all of the information that we have. We have to do a rigorous analysis to make that conclusion. And one of those uses that must be maintained and protected is an aquatic life use. So I just wanted to add that to that biological question.
So, in other words, if the danger to the fishery is solely the biological sustainability, a permit that reaches the legislature will have already found that finding. That finding will have already been made by the agency. Is that correct?
The permit wouldn't be issued if the use of the water by the fish could not be maintained and protected. We would not be able to issue the permit. So we would have to conclude through our analysis that that use would be maintained and protected, and the fish using the water would be maintained and protected, yes.
Does that include daily use or just normal use, or would that also include something like a catastrophic failure?
That includes the project. We don't permit for catastrophic failure, and probably Jack might be able to address that question.
It's true. Our regulations, let's just say on the DNR side for reclamation and closure, the bonding levels are to meet likely and probable costs of closure. So our regulations don't allow us to bond for catastrophic events.
Don't require you to, or don't allow you to?
They don't require us to.
They don't require you to. Okay, and I guess what I'm going to ask between DNR and DEC, if you could look at that question a little bit more, because I think the fundamental question is, if danger to the fishery essentially is the biological sustainability of the fishery as opposed to other economic issues that might be occasioned by this, as you've testified, it'd be important to have on the record where the law today prevents you from issuing a permit for a mine if there is, quote-unquote, danger to the fishery in a biological sense. And I think what you've just described from DEC is fairly accurate. I think the catastrophic question is one where, I know that the Pebble Partnership has pointed out a number of possible catastrophes that could hurt the fishery, from, you know, another eruption of Katmai to a major storm that are not within human control. But at any rate, I think that would be important to have on the record. So if you've got that citation there, Michelle, that's important to have, and thank you for bringing that up.
I will send that, Lieutenant Governor.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
Just one final thing from me. I just wanted to express my appreciation to Michelle and DEC as well. I think that hit the nail on the head. The permit wouldn't be issued if it would not meet those requirements. I think that speaks to our position very effectively, and I appreciate that it is now on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Our next hearing on this issue will be Monday in Kodiak. And I look forward to being in Kodiak if the airplanes are flying. Last time we did this, we couldn't get there. But it'll be Monday at 1 o'clock in the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers, 710 Mill Bay Road from 1 to 3. And the 800 number to get online to be part of that hearing is 855-463-5009. And I'd like to thank the pro side, the con side, the agency folks, and the people who've called in to testify, and the people who've come here to observe for making this a successful hearing. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned.